Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disabilities who have taken from them or are denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those about them. Disrespect welcomes Holly Rose, Community Services Manager for Mission Services. That service includes their food bank. Holly, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I came to you because I'd heard that Mission Services was tightening its eligibility for access to the food bank, and this was, to me, was disturbing because it meant either you were coming under the grip of outside forces that were forcing you not to serve the people you wanted, or you had made decisions about who should be served that I wasn't aware of. It turns out to be both and not a bad thing. Broadly, what has happened at Mission Services for you to structure access to the food bank in this way? Were these rules pre-existing?
In the past, they have been pre-existing. When I came here, they had kind of fallen by the wayside. We had a lot of double use, and we needed a way to...
What's double use?
So that's when someone's using the service more than they should be using it, and that means someone else doesn't have access to it.
All right.
So this requires some more responsibility on our part in tracking who's using the service and are we providing it equitably to everyone who's coming to the door. And if we're providing service, you know, more than once a month to an individual in the different individuals in the community and others only once, it's not really equitable, is it? So one of the things that we did was we really ensured that clients are using our program once a month versus more than once.
Okay.
The other thing that we did was the financial means test, and we did this also in response to some people in the community who generously share with our agency, and they were asking about, you know, who are you serving?
Right.
Some of the individuals that we were serving, when we did end up measuring their income, had significantly larger income than we had expected.
All right.
And what happened was by us measuring it, this disqualified them so that those who actually have a lower income, namely, you know, OW recipients and individuals who are really on the bottom level of the economic financial scale will be able to access the food bank to cover over their food needs.
Okay. And in the meantime, are you involved in outreach to expand the resources of Mission Services in this regard, or is that someone above you or beside you?
No, that's what we're doing, but we also need to manage the resources in the sense that food banks often just deliver based on demand. They don't look at who are they serving. And, you know, that was part of our issue. We need to ask, well, who are we serving? We want to make sure that those that we're serving are in need. So we're using the financial test to do that.
Okay.
And then in order to justify us asking for resources from the community who are already sharing with us, we really need to be accountable for where those resources are going.
Okay. So now you have a pretty clear picture.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. So when people ask the question, you have a clear answer too.
That's right.
Oh, good.
So I know within the summertime program, we are looking to incorporate more fresh produce to fill in some of the gaps. And we also we've worked to put out any of the excess or extra stuff that we get in during that time in the hallway. We're trying to create a place where the excess in our food bank is shared with other food banks, but also it can be given to those who say, may not be able to come into the food bank or may not qualify. So there are resources that are being given out and available to those who even don't qualify, and we are looking to expand that for everyone.
Do I understand then that resources for the other food banks go out in the hallway, or no? Those are resources for local people.
If we have a truck load of potatoes and right. It exceeds our storage capacity, we call up the different food banks in the city to see where the need is.
Right.
Or sometimes, depending on if the need is high, then we rotate. We go through a list. We do this to build relationships, so we're working together with the food banks in the city, but also to try and extend. The whole main reason is to share amongst all of us, and then anything that we have, even then, that's extra, we put out in the hallway as well.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Are there food banks that you don't share with?
No.
Okay.
Not one.
Well, tell me what the experience is then for someone who comes to Mission Services, and you said that qualifying, if you have the right level of income, is not a problem. What if you come and you've qualified in the past, but now you don't? What is the experience like?
Okay. For those who don't qualify, we still serve them the day of. So that person who is in an emergency food, who has emergency food type situation, still gets service that particular day.
Okay.
We always try to find people the resources they need, especially when we do see someone who doesn't qualify. It's often another issue. It's not even always financial. Sometimes there are other extenuating circumstances in that person's life, then they need, assistance. So we try to refer them to services that might better help them to deal with the other issues in their life.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that happens is, it's not just about the financial criteria, and I want to stress that. We do look at the cumulative, the whole, situation a person is facing. We've seen people come to the food bank who definitely don't qualify financially, but we also know that they've just lost their jobs. They're not able to make their car payment or,
all right.
They've got children, and they're in a desperate situation. We've seen that increasingly.
Yeah.
But we're definitely here to help those individuals as well. And the financial criteria just allows us to do the assessment from a stable core. A consistent method of evaluating the person's circumstance. It's only a starting point, but it's
right.
not the whole. So there are many people who do use our food bank who sometimes will not qualify,
mm-hmm.
But will receive assistance at any rate based on our evaluation of that circumstance.
I've heard another food bank express that they are looking for a stable basis to qualify people on, so that if they have people who need the food bank, like you, that they get the resources. And I think they're searching for a qualifying process of some kind, whether it's objective like yours or subject to maybe a few basic qualifiers that probably do include income and expenses, but also probably include other impressions, as you've mentioned.
Right. We do belong to something that's called Emergency Food Administration Council.
Okay.
And there are members from every food bank, represented by every food bank in the city, sit on this committee, and they work together to try and strategize surrounding that kind of issue that you just brought up.
Yeah.
In particular, the means test is something that I'm hoping that we might be able to discuss this year, and I've spoken to some other people who've expressed the same, so where we could try to collectively come together so that we're looking at something, a stable measure for
across the board.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
But that may take some work because all of us are serving different people in different areas. I know with our own means test, we had to raise the cutoff because our clients are, where we are located in the city, have slightly more higher income,
mm-hmm.
whereas the food bank that we had taken the test from is serving a client with actually a little bit, an income base that's slightly lower. So,
oh.
Yeah.
Are you allowed, well, allowed is the wrong word. Do you feel it's a good idea to say who you took the measure from?
I'm not comfortable doing that.
Okay.
But they are a large food bank within
okay.
the city, and they are one of the only other agencies using a means test. So you can maybe deduce that on your own. But.
And this is an established use of a means test or
correct.
New use?
No, it's established. It's been around for a long time. That's why we took it.
Okay.
We took that. They are very good at what they do, and they provide very good service. I've been there, and I've seen them serving similar client base to ours. Yep.
I used a food bank, that I haven't used since because of my experience there. And that was about, I'm trying to think how long ago, probably 10 years ago.
Oh, wow.
And I went in there with a disability benefit, and the lady behind the counter, whom I think I've encountered only once in the food bank system since, said, "You should be ashamed of yourself, you know, with all this money." And I'm thinking, oh, what money, you know? I mean, buying gloves is a problem in the wintertime. She says, all this money. She says, "You shouldn't even be here, you know. We'll serve you this time, but don't come back." And I thought, wow, you know, like, you know, I don't want to go there again. And I guess she established her purpose and was effective, but it was a very depressing.
Was that within our organization?
No.
Okay.
No, I wouldn't bring it up if it were. And I haven't been back since, and I've never encountered this kind of response since then. I wonder how people with disabilities are affected by your new screening method, and if they are affected by it, if they segment into different groups that are affected in different ways. I only mention people with disabilities because I know they start from a higher baseline income.
That's correct, yes. You're correct on one level where you say that some who are receiving disability will not be eligible.
Mm-hmm.
We do have trustee clients who are on ODSP. Trusteeship here is where we manage the money for. We actually provide the budgeting, and we manage that voluntarily.
So the check, in fact, comes to your organization.
Correct, yes.
Yeah. Okay.
So we know where the money is going, and many of those individuals do not qualify for the food bank. We know how much expendable income they have and where it's going because we're part of that management process.
Yeah.
On the other hand, there are many of them that from time to time they have certain circumstances, and we make exceptions. Actually, we do that regularly for many of the clients.
Yeah.
And we do that for those outside of the trusteeship as well. The option is for anyone who does not qualify, who mm-hmm. feels in some way that they're unhappy with that decision, mm-hmm. always has the opportunity to speak with management.
Mm-hmm.
So if they leave their information, we will discuss it and reevaluate the situation. And many times we help the individual or accommodate that person. Sometimes that means providing food at a different time if they're not able to get here.
Right.
We try to be as reasonable as possible.
Let's take a break with Bon Ton Garlo. I'm hurt.
Well, I done got fed up, just can't stand it no more. So I guess, pretty baby, I'll have to let you go. You're a wine-drinking woman, don't even mean yourself no good. You don't do nothing but raise sand in the neighborhood. But I ain't mad, baby. Just a little hurt, that's all. But every time Christmas rolls around, I'm still in my overall. Now what you do when you go around there, I'd really love to see. Whatever it is surely running me. You came in this morning about the break of day, then you had the nerve to tell me you were letting the bar town roulette. But I ain't mad, baby. Just a little hurt, that's all. But every time Christmas rolls around, I'm still in my overall. Now my papa told me about my mama cry, and warned me about those women that drink that no good wine. Now I can sit right here and see a thousand miles away. I can't understand, baby, why you get soused up every day. Now if you don't believe I'm sinking, look what a hole I'm in. If you don't believe I love you, look what a fool I've been. But I ain't mad, baby. I'm just hurt, that's all. So straighten up, pretty baby. I'm waiting for your call.
You've been listening to Holly Rose, in charge of community services at Mission Services, talk to us about the restructuring of priorities for qualification at the food bank.
Oftentimes, I know there's one other thing I'd like to say, which is concerning those who don't qualify for the food bank. Whenever we get calls from people who advocate on behalf of those who haven't qualified, there's often many factors that.
Oh, you do get calls from advocates? You mean like personal advocates or professional advocates?
Professional sometimes.
Okay.
And oftentimes, more often than not, I'd say at least 95% of the time, there's some aspect of the evaluation process that the advocate does not know about.
Okay.
So, for example, if a client was aggressive or violent to a staff or another person there, we are not able to serve them, because of it's a health and safety issue.
Right.
It makes other people there uncomfortable who are there just to get food.
Right.
So we're not going to accommodate that kind of aggressive behavior.
Right.
They may not know about an income source that was reported to us. So they may not know the full picture, and we can't disclose it to them based on privacy.
Oh, yeah. I can understand that.
Yeah, so, and confidentiality issues. But
so people try and actually force acceptance sometimes under conditions that aren't honest.
Well, I mean, that's the way. I mean, when someone is not, some people who have been using the system that perhaps, have more income that we are trying to measure for right now and try to remove so that we can actually serve those who really have that need. They know exactly how it works. If you don't get your way, then you call someone to advocate for you and you're going to get what you want, right?
Oh.
But the reality is that there often is information or some aspect of evaluation that the advocate does not know about.
All right.
And we are not able to disclose. But
yeah.
If we say no, there usually is a good reason.
Yeah. Is it true then that somebody with a check from ODSP generally works from a position of basically guilty of having too much income until proven innocent, or is that below the bar?
No. We don't really look at, I mean, many of our clients are on ODSP.
Okay.
It's not, we don't say, oh, you're on ODSP. We just look at the income. Everybody, even on ODSP, there's a lot of variation depending on the family size and what that person's needs are.
Right.
And whether or not they pay market rent or they have subsidized rent, there's so many factors that contribute to the financial situation.
Okay.
So we don't really look at someone and say, oh, no, you don't qualify. We look at every single person individually.
Yeah, you mentioned that you have a revealing approach to treating income supports in that you, the way you take supports into account was interesting to me, that you would regard someone without supports differently than you would regard someone with supports, for instance, if you have subsidized rent.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody with a whopping rent subsidy and a whopping rent subsidy comes in and says, here's my check. It includes some special qualifications and it's $1,500 a month and I only pay $100 a month rent. Even if they had a bachelor apartment, you'd have to regard them as having another $500 a month income component that wasn't laid out in dollars and cents. It was, in fact, a subsidy.
Oh, okay. I think I'm understanding. It's just I think we're using different terms.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Understand it. Basically, we look at the income. I'm just going to explain it the way that I understand it. And if you have $2,000 a month income and you're paying $200 a month rent,
right?
And say after I deduct all your fixed expenses, which are your hydro, loan payments, whatever, you're left with $950, okay?
Yeah.
I'm just asking, there's $950, and so what we say is...
For food and clothing and stuff like
that. Yeah, yeah, after all the other stuff, after the hydro, after, the water bill, whatever it is that you're paying.
Yep.
And we say, okay, so where did the $950 go? We're putting pressure on people to prioritize food in that $950 before coming and using the service. I mean, because there are many individuals who are on $500 OW, right? Mm. OW a month, they're paying $450 rent, and they've got $50 for the rest of the month.
Yeah.
So they don't really have a choice about prioritizing that $50
food. That's true.
Whereas someone who may be on ODSP and has that $900 has a little bit more leeway. They're not under as much pressure. I'm not, depending on what their circumstances are, that's the assumption, as someone who's really at the line.
I think the intention is that they're not under as much pressure, but then the question is, what are they doing with it?
Well, that's where it's requiring some accountability from the individuals who are recipients, right? Mm. And I mean, if we're just simply asking clients to prioritize the food part. And that's in their own interest, right?
Some people don't prioritize food. I found this out to my surprise that for some people, for example, they'll live on crackers or bread for a week and a half rather than set a different priority. Or I suppose some of them will live on Kraft dinner for extended periods of time because that enables them to have a discretionary money that they otherwise wouldn't have had. Mm. But it's not always necessary, especially if you're not on OW.
I'll tell you a story about a client, actually, who came in at Christmas time and did not qualify.
Oh.
And argued with me back and forth because we weren't happy with the food bank program manager's answer to that question about eligibility. And I said, okay, well, I'm going to go over the income stuff again. We're going to look. And this person had about $1,200 of expendable income.
Oh, you mean like discretionary income beyond rent and utilities.
Right. I mean, even if it was $500 or $600, I think it would be more reasonable.
Uh-huh.
But, I mean, you're looking at $1,200 after all the expenses.
Okay.
And I asked, are there medical costs? Is there something that we just don't know? Where is it going?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that person explained all the other expenses, which did include stuff like cell phone, what kinds of things.
They explained or you explained?
No. This person explained to me.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Showed me some cell phone, charges and then some really expensive internet package with, satellite and all kinds of other stuff, which, anyways, I said, okay, well, if you really are in need of the food, then why are you spending all the money over here, right? Is there any way that you can be cutting back? And that person said to me, oh, what'd she say? She said, I don't need to do that because I come here every month.
Oh, really?
That's exactly what she said. Yeah.
I see.
Yeah. And that was just so illuminating because it said, well, we're just another service that's tacked on to the expendable income. Whereas whether you're on ODSP or OW or you're working, because, I mean, we've got working clients as well.
Yeah.
There's a certain responsibility for finances that we all have to take for ourselves, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, some individuals have an easier time doing that than others, we recognize.
I'm sorry. Yeah. It can be hard. It can be hard to put something first because you have to when it's not what you want to. But that's what I'll tell you a story. I looked for a place that was within the budget that ODSP provides, and I found one, and it was very small, but it wasn't oppressively small. It wasn't a basement with a 6-foot, 6-inch ceiling or an attic where most of the floor space was under sloping eaves. It was just basically a room with a narrow kitchen off it and a bathroom. And the landlord, who was unbeknownst to me, was selling the building at the time, said to me, are you going to be happy in a space like this? And I said to him, well, I think I used Dubai. I said, I imagine that the Prince of Dubai probably wishes he had a nicer place, but he has to, this is prescient, he has to respect the income and the resources at his disposal. And the guy smiled and he said, so, yeah, we all have limits. And I said, yeah, exactly. I said, sure, I'd like a nicer place. I said, but this is the level of my income and so this is what I'm going to live in. And believe me, I've looked around, and there's a lot worse at the price that you're asking. And prescient, because Dubai, of course, is having its own financial problems right now. I don't know if you're aware. But, that was my distillation of the necessity of it's not always easy to do. But with the fixed expenses, it's almost imperative to do because, they don't change every month. And if you have a problem built into your fixed expenses, then you have a problem every month. Yeah, it's true. Well, we're coming to the end of the time that I would normally spend with an interview like this. Is there an area of this topic that we haven't covered that you would like to expound on?
I think it was, it's just the main point that I would like to really get across about with all the focus and discussion on the financial test is the holistic way that we do actually deal with everyone who does come in. We look at the whole situation of each individual. It's not just about dollars and cents. Everybody who comes in here, we want to treat them with dignity.
Right.
We want to acknowledge their individuality and personhood and circumstances. So those are components that can be just as strong, if not stronger, than the financial aspect. But the financial aspect of the evaluation process is something that allows us to be accountable, actually, to those who are in need and help us serve them better.
Yeah. The challenges that you face in an area where incomes are rising, and yet I suppose for those people obligations are rising as well, and so you have a difficult time evaluating, without an objective standard, you have a difficult time evaluating who's really squeezed and who's not.
That's right. Yeah.
All right. Thanks, Holly.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Holly Rose, in charge of community services at Mission Services, talk to us about the restructuring of priorities for qualification at the food bank. And now it's time for Disrespect's take on the news of the past week. That was from The Spectator, no reporter credited. This is about another doctor from The Globe, by Anna Mailer, Paperny, and Joss Wingrove. Doctor under fire for allegedly abusing welfare requests. A Toronto doctor connected to the anti-poverty movement could lose his medical license after he allegedly signed paperwork that allowed welfare recipients to collect extra money for ailments such as diabetes, food allergies, and gout without confirming they had these conditions. The city's welfare office is apparently rejecting special dietary allowance requests from Roland Wong, a Chinatown doctor the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Ontario is investigating for allegedly signing an unknown number of forms dating back to 2004, when he headed a call from the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty to vouch for everyone who requested the allowance. The first question always asked, Dr. Wong says, is, are these people scamming the system? I would say no. When former Premier Mike Harris came in, they reduced all benefits by 25%. Rather than dismissing them as scammers, help them if you can. The Special Dietary Allowance Program now costs the province 12 times what it did 9 years ago. This is largely because of a campaign by advocacy groups critical of Ontario Works allowance amounts, the province's Auditor General concluded in a report released this week. The province spent $67 million on special dietary allowances in the 2008-2009 fiscal year, up from $5 million in 2002-03. Programs designed to provide as much as $250 extra a month for ailing welfare recipients to buy healthy food, $42 a month for diabetes, $75 or more for HIV/AIDS, $35 for a milk allergy, and $20 for extreme obesity, for example. Dr. Wong insists he is bending the rules, not breaking them. He sees himself as a specialist in community medicine with a responsibility to marginalized people. Poverty is pervasive, and we know that poverty is the major determinant of health. Given that, can we just let it go on, he said, adding, you realize this whole thing is brought against me by politicians, not patients. Ontario Coalition Against Poverty organizer John Clark said his group has been getting calls since early October from hundreds of welfare recipients whose special diet allowance applications have been denied, all of them signed by Dr. Wong. No one at the city was able to confirm that, but Mr. Clark provided a copy of an email from a manager with the city social services department saying the office is no longer accepting forms from Dr. Wong because he has posted a notice saying he would no longer sign them at his Spadina clinic. This is from The Spectator, guaranteed income urge for poor. Ottawa, a Senate report on poverty says tax benefits for the poor should be increased to give them a guaranteed income equal to what is called the low income cutoff line. The report from the Social Affairs Committee urges a federal minimum wage of $10 and says that child tax benefits should gradually rise to $5,000. The report says government's goal should be to get people out of poverty rather than trying to make poverty more manageable. The 74 recommendations in the 290-page report cover everything from the general problems of getting people off welfare to social housing, help for Aboriginals and refugees, and a federal-provincial strategy for early childhood education. It says existing programs often have unintended perverse effects that actually help trap people in poverty. At the same time, these programs don't provide enough to ensure the poor can meet basic needs. 30-some years ago, a little prairie town was the subject of a radical social experiment everyone was talking about. Guarantee all families an annual income and see what happens. Would residents be happier, healthier? Would children stay in school longer? But the experiment, which was paid for by the federal and provincial governments and cost $17 million at the time for two sites, ran out of funding midway through. The data was shelved and largely forgotten. University of Manitoba Professor Forget will discuss the experiment as part of the first of three lectures with an anti-poverty theme called Social Science in the City. The experiment, called MINCOME, was conducted in Dauphin, Manitoba, between 74 and 79. Winnipeg was the second site. Forget says results from the Winnipeg site showed people with regular full-time jobs made virtually no change in their work hours. Married women effectively used the guaranteed income to buy themselves longer maternity leaves, so they extended the period of time they were out of the workforce, and adolescents reduced their number of hours worked substantially. They didn't quit school and take full-time jobs. We had a lot more kids continuing to grade 11 and 12. She added there was a dramatic reduction in hospital admissions, especially for mental health. Forget doesn't know exactly why, but based on her knowledge of the study, thinks it may have been a result of less stress associated with managing a family on a low income. Accidents and injuries were also reduced, she believes, because people were less likely to be needy enough to take dangerous jobs. In all of the indicators I could find for quality of life, people did better. And tonight, Thursday, February 25th, economist and professor Evelyn Forget is coming to Hamilton to reveal the results and tie those into how poverty impacts health. At talk tonight, The Town with No Poverty, Thursday, February 25th, the Hamilton Spectator Auditorium, 44 Frid Street. Doors open at 6:30 p.m., lecture at 7 p.m. Admission is free, but reserve a seat by emailing sciencecity@mcmaster.ca. Or call McMaster, extension 24934. Urban food strategy unveiled. Board of Health wants people to have better access to quality food. Again, Anna Mailer-Paperny. David McCown is out to change the way you think about food, what you eat, where it comes from, where you buy it, and how you consume it. Toronto's Board of Health is unveiling a wide-ranging food strategy whose broad and lofty goals include creating food-friendly neighborhoods, connecting city-dwelling consumers to rural producers, and eliminating hunger. McCown emphasizes its early days. Toronto's Medical Officer of Health says this strategy is a policy paper only. With a mandate from the Board of Health, the food strategy's backers hope months of consultation will let them bring specific recommendations to City Council in June. Says McCown, the food system that we have now broadly was developed in the post-war period and was really designed to keep prices low and maximize the amount of food that goes out there. But that food, despite the fact that food prices are relatively low historically, is still not affordable for people who are of low income. Almost 20 years after the city created one of North America's first food councils, Toronto still has glaring food deserts, areas where there's simply nowhere to buy decent food nearby. That's one obvious area where the city can play an active role, McCown says, by using zoning bylaws to encourage grocery stores to set up shop in neighborhoods that are lacking. There's a number of levers that city governments have, he said. Food programs, community gardens, communal food education, these kinds of things can help the city to achieve its objectives in terms of addressing the needs of inner city communities. But University of Toronto geography professor Pierre Desrochers argues this overarching food strategy is a pie-in-the-sky way of trying to address real needs. If the city wants to tackle poverty, he says, it should look at economic development. There are such things as economies of scale in food production, he said. They want to replace professionalized, large-scale food systems with grassroots-oriented programs that won't be able to do it as efficiently. You'll end up paying more for your food. How is that helping poor people? Leslie Beck, Food for Thought, in the Globe and Mail. Rethinking saturated fat. It's not the enemy. We've been told for decades to lower our intake of saturated fat to guard against heart disease. The rationale? Saturated fat can raise LDL, bad cholesterol in the blood, a risk factor for heart attack and stroke. But according to a new report that will be published in the March issue of the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, there's no evidence that saturated fat is linked with a higher risk of heart disease. The studies have shown a beneficial effect on heart disease risk by lowering saturated fat. Are ones that have replaced saturated fat with polyunsaturated fat. The main sources of polyunsaturated fat include cooking oils. For example, sunflower, safflower, soybean, corn, grapeseed, hemp, flaxseed, and walnut oil, and oily fish. In people with high blood cholesterol, replacement of saturated fat with polyunsaturated fat has been reported to reduce the liver's production of LDL, cholesterol, and speed its removal from the bloodstream. Lowering saturated fat and increasing polyunsaturated fat has also been shown to decrease hardening of the arteries in animals. When it comes to preventing heart disease, dietary carbohydrate also must be addressed. Substituting saturated fat with a high intake of carbohydrate, such as bread, rice, pasta, and low-fat baked goods has not been shown to protect against heart disease. In fact, doing so may increase the risk in certain people. Replacing saturated fat with carbohydrate, especially refined, in conjunction with obesity can create a metabolic environment that favors heart disease by boosting triglyceride fat, lowering HDL cholesterol, and increasing small, dense LDL particles. Evidence suggests that limiting carbohydrate intake can reduce elevated blood triglycerides and dense LDL cholesterol and increase HDL cholesterol. The type of carbohydrate you eat, measured by the glycemic index, may also play a role in heart disease. High glycemic foods with a high GI or glycemic index, such as white bread, white rice, refined breakfast cereals, sweets, and sugary drinks, are digested quickly and cause faster spikes in blood glucose. Over time, this can lead to insulin resistance, a condition in which the body cannot effectively remove glucose from the bloodstream. Insulin resistance, in turn, increases the risk for developing type 2 diabetes and metabolic syndrome, two potent risk factors for heart disease. Low glycemic foods are more gradually converted to blood glucose and include grainy breads, brown rice and pasta, sweet potatoes, bran cereals, steel cutter, large flake oatmeal, legumes, yogurt, milk, and most types of fruit. Limiting refined carbohydrates, sugar and white flour products, for example, losing excess weight, and emphasizing polyunsaturated fats from vegetable oils and fish appear to do more to lower your risk of heart disease than simply giving up cheese. And now we'll take a short break. We'll be back with the rest of the news. This is Guitar Slim, New Arrival.
I got a good-looking woman. She stays out all the time. If she keep a hard head, she gonna drive Slim out of his mind.
From the Globe and Mail, the Zakansky increase by Jim Bronskill in Ottawa, RCMP to overhaul policy on taser use. The RCMP plan a sweeping overhaul of their taser policy following recommendations from inquiries prompted by the death of Polish immigrant Robert Zakansky. An internal briefing note obtained by the Canadian Press says the Mounties are recommending 4 dozen specific changes on stun gun use. The briefing note states that although there has been preliminary consultation within the force and with partner agencies, further consultations will be required in order to finalize the draft policy before being submitted to the Commissioner for final approval. Once the final taser policy is approved, there will be an immediate impact on operations and training, which will have to reflect the policy changes, says the November note, released under the Access to Information Act. Mr. Zakansky, who hoped to join his mother in British Columbia, died in October 2007 after being hit with a Mountie taser at the Vancouver airport. A video of the confrontation taken by a fellow air passenger, in which a confused, sweaty Mr. Zakansky is zapped repeatedly, was seen by millions of people, triggering public outrage and a fundamental reexamination of stun gun use. And we've had a number of examinations of policy at Sick Children's Hospital recently. This article doesn't name Sick Children's Hospital, but it's about an event where Oliveri was a researcher at Sick Children's Hospital. Oliveri honored for drug study ethics, says the Spectator. A Toronto doctor is being recognized for her courage after she defied a drug company and warned patients of potential dangers of a drug she was studying. Dr. Nancy Oliveri is the 2009 recipient of the Scientific Freedom and Responsibility Award from the American Association for the Advancement of Science. That's the same organization that publishes the prestigious journal Science. In the mid-1990s, Hamilton-born Oliveri was conducting a clinical trial on a pill being tested as a potential treatment for the rare blood disorder, thalassemia. She expressed her concerns in a medical journal despite having signed a confidentiality agreement with drug maker Apotex. The controversy sparked debate over ethics and academic freedom faced by researchers who do clinical trials funded by drug companies. And in The Spectator, compiled by Florence Ciccoli, FDA limits use of asthma drugs. The U.S. government is taking steps to curb the use of some long-acting asthma drugs taken by millions of people. Do you take these drugs? The Food and Drug Administration's warnings cover the drugs Advair, Symbicort, Foradil, and Seravent. The Food and Drug Administration has issued restrictions to lower an uncommon but potentially life-threatening risk that asthma could worsen suddenly. The FDA says these drugs should be used only by asthmatics who can't control their lung disease with other medications, and then only for the shortest time possible. Spectator again. Area's rising EI welfare numbers a worrying trend. Hamilton, that's Steve Arnold in the spec. Hamilton has bucked the national trend in unemployment insurance recipients again. The number grew here in December while it dipped in the rest of the country. New figures from Stats Canada released show 10,800 people drawing regular EI benefits in December. That's up 6.2% from the 10,170 recorded in November. The year-over-year number is even worse, up 49.2% from the 7,280 in December 2008. At the same time, the city's Ontario Works office shows the welfare caseload has also spiked to a three-year high of 13,376. For labor activists such as Mary Long, president of the Hamilton and District Labor Council, the rising number is only part of the problem. This number certainly doesn't show the full complement of the unemployed, she said. What it shows is there's still an onslaught of good jobs leaving Hamilton on a regular basis. Sid Ryan, president of the Ontario Federation of Labour, blamed several factors for the slow rate of job recovery, including high electricity costs that hurt energy-intensive industries such as steel and free trade agreements that allow American companies to take Canadian jobs. Ryan's solution lies in more economic stimulus from the provincial and federal governments, programs that are threatened now as both Queen's Park and Ottawa talk about deficit reduction as their top priority. We're saying they should look at deficit reduction over the longer term, 6 or 7 years rather than 2 or 3, he said. We're saying government should stay the course and put people back to work. And this from Alberta. Via the Globe and Mail, Nathan Vanderclip in Edmonton. In a season of restraint, Alberta opts to spend. Province announces record shortfall in face of oil industry strife, suggesting tough choices ahead as Ottawa prepares forecast. The Alberta government is saddling itself with another blockbuster deficit as it moves to increase spending in a time of continued financial hardship. The province has detailed plans for a record $4.7 billion deficit for fiscal 2010-2011 as it augments spending on health care and education without raising taxes. These are difficult times, and difficult times call for difficult choices, Alberta Finance Minister Ted Morton said. Said Jack Mintz, who leads the University of Calgary School of Policy Studies, and criticized previous Alberta administrations for exaggerating the effects of booms and busts with their spending decisions. In my view, having very large cuts at the time when the economy is not doing well is not particularly smart. There's a real need to create some more stability in the face of very volatile revenues, he said. And from the Spectator, Denise Davey, area children wait longer for mental health services. Hamilton and Niagara families wait an average of 19 days for emergency mental health services for children, the longest wait time of any area in the province. Waits here are much longer than provincial average wait time of 3 days, according to the first province-wide assessment of those services. The area also experiences delays far beyond the provincial average in early intervention programs for kids and specialized intensive treatment. The alarming data was revealed in a massive mapping exercise undertaken by the Ministry of Children and Youth Services as a way to identify gaps in services. The 70-page report shows Hamilton and Niagara families face the highest wait times for early intervention programs for children, with an average wait of 68 days compared with the provincial average of 17 days. Hamilton and Niagara families face the second highest wait time for highly specialized intensive treatment, waiting an average of 66 days compared with the provincial average of 52 days. That's the second highest wait time next to Toronto, which has 79 days. Hamilton Niagara has the second highest percentage of low-income families in the province, with 18% behind Toronto, which has around 26%. Alex Thompson, executive director of Linwood Hall, an agency that provides mental health services to children and youth, wasn't surprised the Hamilton data showed such long wait times and said it speaks to the lack of funding for children's mental health services. Thompson said his agency and others have gone without base funding increases for years and have had to survive by cutting administration staff. While Hamilton is poorly served in overall services, Thompson said, we're doing a terrible job of helping kids in early intervention. Ministry spokesperson Paris Mayer said the report is the most comprehensive children's mental health data collection ever undertaken across the province and will help inform the ministry on local decision-making. Thompson hopes the mapping project will finally lead to changes. You can't imagine the Health or Education Ministry accepting 0% increases for years, Thompson said. From the Globe, new report raises medical ethical question about vegetative state. He emerged from the car accident alive but alone, wrote Benedict Carey. There and not there, a young man whose eyes opened yet whose brain seemed shut down. For 5 years he lay mute and immobile beneath a diagnosis, vegetative state that all but ruled out the possibility of thought, much less recovery. But in recent months, at a clinic in Liège, Belgium, the patient, now 29, showed traces of brain activity in response to commands from doctors. Now, according to a new report, he's begun to communicate. In response to simple questions such as, "Do you have any brothers?" he showed distinct traces of activity on a brain imaging machine that represented either yes or no. Experts said this week that the finding could alter the way some severe head injuries are diagnosed and could raise troubling ethical questions about whether to consult severely disabled patients on their care. The new report, posted online by the New England Journal of Medicine, did not suggest that most apparently unresponsive patients can communicate or are likely to recover. The hidden ability displayed by the young accident victim is rare, the study suggested. Nor does the finding apply to victims of severe oxygen depletion, such as Terry Schiavo, the Florida woman who became unresponsive after her heart stopped and was taken off life support in 2005 during an explosive controversy over patients' rights. Moreover, experts said, the new test was not ready for wide use as a diagnostic tool. Serious technical challenges remain to be worked out. Still, the experts agreed that the new study exposed the limits of the current bedside tests for diagnosing mental state, checking whether patients' eyes can track objects, and carefully looking for any signals, eye blinks, finger twitches, in response to questions or commands. I'm convinced that as an observer that in these few cases, the MRI technique in these researchers' hands gives us a window into human consciousness that we've not had and that potentially adds to the clinical exam we currently use, said James Burnett, a neurologist at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center in New Hampshire. A two-way channel to an immobilized, severely brain-injured person also opens up a world of ethical challenge. If you ask a patient whether he or she wants to live or die, and the answer is die, would you be convinced that that answer was sufficient? Said Joseph Finns, chief of the Medical Ethics Division at Weill Cornell Medical College in New York. We don't know that. We don't know their We know they're responding, but we may not We know they're responding, but they may not understand the question. Their answer might be yes, but, and we haven't given them the opportunity to say the but. We've opened up a communication channel with this technique, but in some ways it's like a very bad cell phone connection. In an editorial accompanying the article, Alan Roper, a neurologist at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, similarly warns against equating neural activity and identity. Physicians and society are not ready for, "I have brain activation, therefore I am," Dr. Roper wrote. That would be seriously putting Descartes before the horse. And finally, in the news review, "Duck Teaches Boy" by Michael Kesterton in the Globe and Mail. A boy with cerebral palsy has learned to walk after watching a disabled duckling, the Plymouth England Herald reports. The duckling, a Plymouth woman, and her disabled son were brought together by a twist of fate with life-changing consequences. Becky Lomax rescued the duckling when it was just a day and a half old, as it was going to be put down after being born with a splay leg. Basically, when it lay down or sat down, its leg was right up near its head, and it was unable to walk, says Becky. After nursing, the duckling is now able to walk. But it's not just the cute duckling who is now getting around. Amazingly, Becky's 4-year-old son, Finley, who suffers from cerebral palsy, has copied its progress. "This is the most amazing thing, because in doing physio on the duckling, the same as I do for my son, Finley took his first 3 steps after watching me doing the physio with the duckling." And that's the news this week for Disrespect. Come back next week, we will have more. And now for foodies, we have an appropriate going out song, Katie Webster, "A Little Meat on the Side."
Now listen up, fella, what I say is
If you can't access a Disrespect broadcast, you can now listen to the show wherever you're near an internet download. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at showtime to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.